Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton has a full plate these days at the University of Missouri-Columbia as Mizzou faces the same challenges confronting higher education all across the country. We'll hear from him in just a couple of moments. But first, the new president and CEO of the St. Louis Symphony, Marie-Hélène Bernard, something of a long and winding road that brought her to St. Louis, a journey that included a law degree and work as a tax attorney, and later orchestral fellowship stops at New York, Philadelphia, and Cleveland, among other places. But now she's here, ready for the start of a new season this week, the renewal of the Saturday night broadcasts on St. Louis Public Radio, our season six, by the way. And I'm sure Marie-Hélène brings a determination to build audience for the orchestra. It's so nice to have you here. Welcome to St. Louis.
Thank you.
Well, I have to ask you at the very start, what's more exciting, getting ready for a brand new season with the St. Louis Symphony or throwing out the first pitch at a Cardinal game?
Oh, I think both are so, so exciting, and exciting in a way that it gets me to get to know that community, and it's a really, really wonderful, wonderful city.
You know, I would rather start a symphony season than throw out the first pitch. I would think that would be terrifying.
It's an experience to have. I must say it's unique, but I was very proud and also very honored to be invited.
What do you think of St. Louis so far?
Rich community, very warm, very mixed, great cultural institutions, great history. I think there's so much going on here, and I think there's a really great place for music and a deep love for music and for the St. Louis Symphony.
It really has a pretty significant place on the cultural map, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, right.
I'd like to talk, before I talk music and about some of the things mm-hmm. you're going to be doing in your new job, a little bit about you. What drew you away from the world of tax attorneydom to the world of music?
I wouldn't say drew me away, but I grew up in a very musical household. My mother was a musician. Her brother was a very renowned organist who actually trained several organists and harpsichordists in North America. So grew up in a very, very musical environment and went to law school because I sought some great professional experiences and really enjoyed a practice. But I think at some point missed music and really looked at various ways to get reengaged in the world of music, and having then been in Montreal for a while and saw that the opportunities there were quite limiting and limited, so moved to the U.S. To really pursue a career in music management. So for me, it's all connected and integrated because I was bringing the legal business expertise to my love and passion for music and to share it with a great number of people.
How to connect the dots between the two? How does the expertise in one area influence you in the other?
Well, the nature of our work, you are truly, in terms of looking at what symphony orchestras are doing, is really to bring communities and people together. It's really to enrich the lives of people on so many different levels. So you need the good business skills because you're running a business like any other nonprofit business. So you need some skills in terms of accounting, finances, mm-hmm. relationship building, corporate expertise. But we also need to sell tickets and develop audiences and also raise money. So I think the experience as an attorney was tremendously helpful in terms of the structure, the way you analyze, the way the whole, you know, background that you need and in developing also relationships and convincing people. I think we're in a business of bringing people together. It's really important.
How does one do that in your position? I'm not sure that everybody listening now mm-hmm. fully understands what the president and CEO of a symphony mm-hmm. orchestra does.
Mm-hmm. Well, you set directions, you inspire, you lead, you motivate. You're really taking care of a lot of people internally, externally. So you need to engage important opinion leaders and leaders to really set the course for this organization. You need to make a community feel included and that the symphony is a destination and is a place where it's good to be. And we have a huge role as an education leader. So I think all of these pieces are tremendously important. And in my role, I'm really guiding all of these elements and also recruiting good people, keeping them with us, and really fostering a sense of community through the music that we give.
And how do you work with the music director, the conductor?
It's
the maestro.
It's a very, very close partnership. It's a constant dialogue we have. We are very fortunate in having David Robertson here as music director. He's a brilliant man. He's a thoughtful musician. He's a very skilled programmer, and he cares about audiences tremendously, and he understands it. It's quite a gift that David has as a musician to be able to communicate with so much passion and to make it accessible to everyone, which is a rare gift. And he understands the business, which is also quite an asset. So he and I have very, very good conversations about planning, about the future, the kind of experience we want to create. And he and the team then go to kind of flesh out the programming that goes to convey that vision.
Are the two of you involved in the programming, deciding what's going to be played and when and how?
Yeah, I'm always involved at the high level in terms of setting the directions, and David works on the kind of minutiae or the details with his team of really programming the pieces. And, you know, it's a balancing act to make sure that you always bring new things, different things, but also that you bring works that people love to hear. And every performance is different, even if the works are from a different era or new. It's a performance, the experience that we bring, that is truly the magic.
I'm assuming that the pieces were pretty much in place for this coming season.
Yes. Before
you got here.
Yes.
I also, having read some interviews with you and some things that have been written about you since you've come here, you apparently did a lot of due diligence before you made the decision to come.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things that you found and some of the things that you think are perhaps subject to change?
You know, this orchestra being the second oldest in America and one of the finest, truly, it's this organization, this orchestra is poised to really continue to achieve amazing things artistically. So when I came, and in considering what we could do, is to kind of reconnect the community with a sense of purpose with the music we offer. I think we have a wide variety of programs that we do. I think that there are some communities that are not served sufficiently by the symphony. So in looking at who needs to hear us, who is not having the opportunity to really connect with the music making, how can we continue to make music education a priority in our state, in our city, and how do we create impact? You constantly have to ask yourself, how do you create impact in a community? I think in looking at the whole mix of activities and programs we offer, there is very, very high quality in everything we do. We need to continue to really explore how do we reach out and how do we communicate the value of the music that we perform. When you have the most talented musicians in America choosing to live in St. Louis to work with this great organization, that you have a David Robertson who brings tremendous, tremendous musical experiences and baggage, is how do you make this truly a community asset? So I think that in essence is what is guiding everything we're going to do.
What are some of those communities that you've suggested that have not in the past perhaps been well served?
For example, years ago, 30-some years ago, the symphony used to tour the state a lot more, and I really want to reconnect the St. Louis Symphony. It's the finest, one of the finest in America, and I think our state, neighboring states, deserve to hear this great ensemble. I think also in terms of exploring how we have developed an audience that is not necessarily your typical classical music concert goer, and how you create an experience that make them explore other types of music that they don't think that they might like. I always think that music is never the problem, is how you communicate the value of music and how you bring people to experience it.
How do you bring those people who perhaps are not familiar or that you want to familiarize with the music? How do you get them into the tent? Yeah.
Well, I think music is all about emotions, and I think we need to speak of the music in ways that essentially connect people to what they will be experiencing. I think there are many opportunities to provide learning experiences that are not per se telling people will educate you, but I think providing experiences for people to connect and to network and to also feel safe and feel welcome. If there's too much concern about what you don't know about the music, it might prevent you from really truly enjoying it. So I think I want to remove this from an intellectual, cerebral experience to really a sense of feeling and a sense of joy about the music is that you bring joy to a community when you perform.
I think one of the things that that may be an obstacle to symphonic music is people think it's stuffy. They don't understand it. They don't know the composers. They don't know a lot of the music. That's a tough bridge to cross.
It is, but I think if we can approach it in ways that are really changing the face of this organization, and I've done this with other groups, is you really need to question what kind of image do you associate with the music? What kind of, how do you talk about it? And the greatest challenge for us is we're so close to it that you need to step back. And actually, we need to talk to our community. What would make you feel, you know, welcome? What would make you go? What's the barrier for entry? So we're doing a lot of sessions now to get people's input. We're starting a strategic plan, and I'm listening to what people have to say. What is the single, you know, element that would prevent you from coming? Because usually when they do come, the quality of the performance we offer, it's just so exceptional. And the life that this orchestra brings on stage, that it's unique. There is nothing like this in St. Louis, and there's nothing like this in our region. So is how do you create a sense of excitement about it?
You know, so many people I've talked to who have been to Powell Hall for the first time are totally blown away by it. They have no idea prior to the experience itself what a marvelous experience it is.
Yeah,
you've got to get them into the hall.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I know that one of your strategies is to attract younger people. How do you do that?
Same thing. I don't think the music is an issue. I think first we need to start talking to younger people and see, you know, what kind of entertainment they are seeking, what kind of nourishment they are looking for, what kind of time schedule, I mean, people are in different cycles of life at different ages. It's so not, it's hard to predict where people are. If you're looking at people between the ages of 25 and 55, you have a huge range of, you know, lifestyles and different approaches. And I think we are offering a mix of programming for every taste, but I think people's lifestyles kind of get in the way. Our greatest competitor is the lack of time. It's not that we're presenting classical music or that it's given at a different time or at Powell Hall. So I think what you do is you create opportunities for younger people based on their age group to really engage and what is meaningful to them. So we're exploring with several groups what speaks to you and what would make you come.
Yeah, I would think that the music would make a difference for young people, that
Absolutely.
It would have to be something with which they can connect.
And in Boston, we developed, by the time I left, 30% of the audience was under the age of 40, and there was tremendous enjoyment from these younger professionals from all day of life to gather and share the experience of the music, which is unique. You're sharing this. It was developing networks that they could not develop otherwise in other aspects of their lives or at work. And it was giving meaning to being part of a community. And, you know, when people ask me, you know, what keeps you awake at night, and I'm always thinking of the next generation, those who will be caring for our great institutions, who will be there to foster a sense of community importance and connection, and who's going to be there to ensure that a St. Louis Symphony, now in its 136th season, will be here again in 200, 300 years old, years from now.
Develop those future audiences.
Absolutely.
By developing
young. Sure, and we start really young. We start with kids at age 6, and we bring the families along, and it's a lifelong pursuit and love, and your approach and your interaction and your enjoyment of music will change over the years. And that's what I want people to understand. Same with food. You go through phases in life where you like some types of things. You experiment with wine. You experiment with traveling. It's music is no different. And my hope is people get that we've shared the love of exploration and move any kind of fear about what it means when it comes to music.
We've got to take a break now. We are talking with Marie-Hélène Bernard, and she is the new president and CEO of the St. Louis Symphony, just arrived in St. Louis. The season begins this Friday night, the 18th, and it's going to be an exciting season. We'll be talking about that in just a moment. Stay with us. If you'd like to get into the conversation, we'd love to have you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on Air. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Marie-Hélène Bernard. You had a concert last night in Forest Park. How did it go?
Oh, it was fabulous. It was great. We had a wonderful turnout. We're still trying to figure out how many people we had there, but I think we had more people than ever. And I think this concert has been going on for over 10 years. We had never seen such an enthusiastic, devoted audience.
Given what we were talking about before, what was the composition of that audience like? Is it a diverse group?
Oh, absolutely. I think pretty mixed in age, ethnicity, and you know, Forest Park is a gem. It's a very unique place, and it makes St. Louis such a, you know, vibrant community. And you feel the love that our, you know, people here have for this beautiful site. It was a gorgeous day, and for us, it's quite an honor to be able to give a free concert there. So all the elements were in place, and David, you know, every year tries to conduct that concert, and it had just arrived. We had rehearsals for it, and the program was beautiful, and he's such an engaging communicator.
He's got some theater in him. I mean, that would be expected, but he's a showman as well as a gifted musician.
Oh, yes, he has great acting, drama. He has, yes.
This year, I gather, is going to be a little bit different in the way that you're structuring the season. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what you're doing. And I know that you're telling stories through music as much as anything else.
So when David and the team developed this program, the whole theme was music tells a story. And David is really very innovative in the way he approaches music, always in connection with other life experiences through other art forms, through literature. He's a great master of words and loves to read. So he developed that theme so that essentially over the number of, you know, subscription concerts that we have, we also made sure that we had this connection to pieces of music or programming that really connects our audience to the whole concept of telling a story, which is so important. We have, through that, several partnerships with the Shakespeare Festival, and in the time period from about February to March, we've developed programs over a period of 4 weeks where we are really having an emphasis on music written about or around Shakespeare's works.
Could you give us a sense of what some of those might be?
For example, in February, David is bringing, under the guest conductor Hans Graf, Mendelssohn's Midsummer Night's Dream. The week after, there's another guest who's coming to do selection from Romeo and Juliet, and we're doing also from Berlioz with Leonard Slatkin, who's back mid-March. So it's always a pleasure to bring back our former music director, Leonard Slatkin. He's doing Berlioz, Romeo et Juliette. I'm giving you the French pronunciation.
It's very, very pleasant to listen to.
Yes, it brings me a wonderful cast for this. And this orchestra, I must say, plays French music really, really, really well. There's other partnerships we're doing over the season with the zoo. We're doing a family concert in October. And there's other things in the works. And we are, through our community programs also, we are always connecting to other landmarks and institutions in town to bring the music outside of Powell Hall, which is really, really important.
Will the orchestra be performing at the zoo?
It's going to be essentially here. It's part of our family series, but there will be activities with the zoo. And also, of course, as part of the series for the season, we have three concerts that are called Music You Know, and they are really meant to really introduce new audiences to classical music. And David leads these concerts with comments from the stage, and they are fabulous. Last year, I heard two of the three, and it was a new series we introduced, and there's been really wonderful reception for those concerts. So there's quite a mix of everything. And as you know, we have the Live at Powell series, which is a combination of, you know, movies with symphonic music and other shows for the families and also more popular music. And these have been very well received. We're doing a series of holiday concerts starting in early December. We're bringing a whole program of John Williams music, which we all love because his music is so much associated with American, you know, movie making, but also it's truly great music. And by the way, his music is really hard to play. It's not easy. And later we have holiday concerts, we have gospel night. And so we really have a full array of concerts and experiences for everyone from age, very young to quite old.
I was going to say, I can tell just by your reciting what you're going to be doing mm-hmm. all year long, how you're reaching out to the broadest
yes.
possible mm-hmm. spectrum.
Absolutely. And the one thing about this orchestra is they are extraordinarily nimble artistically. I have rarely encountered an orchestra that has the ability to play such a broad range of repertoire in different settings, and they love to communicate, and that's unique. It's not an orchestra that is difficult about the programs they have to play, but they have this nimbleness, which is amazing, to be able to go from Russian repertoire to French to new music to American, and to play pops concerts and opera and things like that. It's quite extraordinary.
What about recording?
We are planning two recordings of John Adams' works. As you know, John Adams, a great American composer, has a very, very close partnership with this orchestra and with David Robertson. Mm-hmm. So we are in the spring, actually it's late winter, we're going to be recording Scheherazade 2, which is one of the works for violin that he's written, and Leila Josefovich is going to be performing it. And there's going to be another work that we'll be recording next season. And this will be, this CD release will coincide with John Adams' 70th birthday in the winter, February of 2017. So as you can imagine, we're constantly working, you know, ahead and planning 2-3 years ahead. So it's always an exercise for the brain to remember what we're doing this year while you're planning 2-3 years out.
Sure. Well, and the symphony has a pretty good record when it comes to recordings and the way they
yes.
are received. The Grammys, the Grammy shelf is almost full, right?
Yeah, which was actually the last one that the symphony won this past winter was for Cité Noir with one work by John Adams. And it was interesting that John chose the St. Louis Symphony to do the recording when the work was actually commissioned by another orchestra. So it speaks of the how highly he values this orchestra in really playing his music.
It's also my understanding that the group is going to be hitting the road this year.
Yes. So we're going to be going to California at the end of January with David. As you know, David Robertson is from California. Mm-hmm. David is giving a work by Messiaen. Olivier Messiaen was a very famous French composer, wrote a piece that is called, and I'm going to give you again the French pronunciation.
I love hearing it. Please do.
Des Canyons. Des Canyons aux Étoiles, From the Canyons to the Stars, which is a work he wrote, I believe, after visiting the canyons in Utah. And as a Frenchman, and I don't remember if it was his first visit in America, but was quite mesmerized by our landscape and wrote that piece after his experience. And it's quite a mystical work. It's fabulous. It's 90 minutes long. We commissioned Deborah O'Grady, who's an artist, to really create a portfolio of photography to convey basically what the composer experienced when he wrote the music. So it will be as much a visual experience, and it will be a combination, a unique experience at Powell Hall. And I really encourage everyone to come hear the work. It's accessible, and we will present an experience in connection to it where David and Deborah on stage will be explaining the work and how it came together and then lead the audience into listening to the performance of it. So I think it's going to be quite special. And this will go on the road to California with a performance of Mahler 5. So it's quite prestigious.
One of the things that people always look at and as a new season approaches mm-hmm. and during the season are the soloists who'll be coming in.
You've got
a heck of a group.
We do. And I'm very impressed not only with the guest conductors, and David is very thoughtful about inviting guests, both conductors and soloists, who are a good fit to our orchestra and also can bring artistic experiences that are different from what he's bringing. I think he's very well aware of that and also showcasing works that he's not going to do. And it's a mix of talent. We still have several members of our orchestra who are performing. So Daniel Lee, cello, next week is performing a work, Don Quixote, and Beth Chu, who's also quite a fabulous viola player, principal player. Later in the season, Will James, who's principal percussion, and Shannon Wood, principal timpani, will be performing works as well. And Shannon will be performing a timpani concerto by Kraft, which is quite also another visual experience. So I'm stressing that because several of our programs, while the theme is music tells a story, there's quite a lot of visual elements in the music that we will be performing this season. And I encourage everyone on April 30th and May 1st to come hear that Kraft timpani concerto. Visually, I don't think anyone will have seen the timpani displayed in such a fantastic way on stage. It's going to be an installation in itself. And there's like a wonderful roster of pianists and singers who will be coming. And I want to mention that Orly Shaham, David Robertson's wife, is back to perform early November with Nick McKeegan, Mozart Piano Concerto. She will be doing the Piano Concerto No. 9. And Orly is a delightful, delightful musician, and I'm really glad we can welcome her back to St. Louis this year.
Only a minute left, but this weekend gets off to a pretty good start, too.
Yes, Joshua Bell is here, and one of the finest violinists, a great, great musician. He's here to play Lalo Symphonie Espagnole, which is actually a work for violin, and it's great to welcome him as we open this wonderful season.
Only a few seconds left. How far ahead are you with regard to planning for next year? You mentioned how difficult it is keeping things in your head, but in 30 seconds.
It's very well underway. It's going to be a really nice St. Louis theme, and I'm not telling you too much to keep the surprise. And we're already looking at 1718 as well. But we're in a planning phase and very excited to be sharing more music with St. Louis.
We'll look forward to hearing and seeing what you're up to in the future. I want to thank you so much for being with us. And again, welcome you to St. Louis.
Thank
Maria
you.
Lynn Bernard, President and CEO of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. The season starts on Friday night. Actually, I guess maybe it started last night in Forest Park, but it's underway in any case. Thank you once again for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Chancellor at Mizzou talks with our Dale Singer. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. The chancellor at the University of Missouri-Columbia has been on the job for 18 months, a time in which R. Bowen Lofton has had to confront many of the key challenges facing all institutions of higher learning, among them diversity issues, health care insurance for grad students, and campus sex abuse. He arrived on campus when the university was in the midst of national publicity after student Sasha Menyukori committed suicide months after she may have been sexually abused. St. Louis Public Radio education reporter Dale Singer talked with Chancellor Lofton about this and other things in a recent interview, and he began by asking how Chancellor Lofton would characterize Mizzou students.
They have strong values. They're very service-focused. We have over 750 organizations on campus that are student-led, and the vast majority are service-focused. They raise money or they perform services to help other people. And that's pretty incredible. You don't find that at a university oftentimes. You find some, but the magnitude of it at Mizzou and the magnitude at Texas A&M were very high. And that's a very attractive thing to find young people not worried about themselves, but trying to do things for others.
When you got to campus, there were a lot of issues that came up that were not pre-existing, particularly Title IX type of things. Talk about how you've handled that and what changes have been made since you got there.
Well, the Sasha Menyukori story broke the weekend before I became chancellor officially. So I was actually on campus getting settled, basically, and this thing happened. Steve Owens was serving as the interim chancellor, and he was on a hunting trip in a place with no cell coverage. And so there was kind of a void of leadership, shall we say, right there. President Wolf, this is the president, was engaged on that situation. He was concerned about it and made a decision that day to begin moving the entire system to a better place in terms of how we address Title IX concerns. Since then, we've done many things. At Mizzou particularly, we have hired a extraordinary individual, Ellen Eardley, as our Title IX administrator. She succeeds Linda Bennett, who was our first full-time administrator that I appointed when I became chancellor. And we have done a lot in terms of training all of our employees, faculty, and staff to be reporters of any events they may see. We have produced, I think, one of the best websites in the country for Title IX reporting and access to information. We put in place a number of programs to both raise awareness and prepare our students to be better able to deal with the those kinds of issues, especially reporting, intervention, and obviously support after the fact. We've strengthened our counseling programs. We've done a lot at the university over the last year plus to be able to totally, I think, take a step to the next level, if you will, in terms of our ability to both deal with the reporting, but also the actual process, if you will. We begin after a report occurs to investigate and deal with the individuals who may be involved, both in a positive way for support, but also in terms of student conduct.
How do you change the culture on campus concerning sexual assault, even before it can get to the reporting stage?
Well, there's several things you can do. For example, Dale, we are very interested in the Green Dot program. The Green Dot program is a program which really says, I'm going to not be an idle bystander. I'm going to watch, and if I see inappropriate behavior, I'm going to intervene. That's not exactly human nature. Most of us walk on by. We don't necessarily stop and think, should I now say something? Should I now try to stop something from happening that I see happening, which is not appropriate? That's not our tendency. So we've really pushed hard on that. Our students have stepped up to it. We have a program called Enough is Enough that's totally student-driven. Our student organization led that effort, and it's a very grassroots approach to saying we're tired of this continuing on our college campus. Let's change the culture. I can't hire enough people as a chancellor to enforce things from a top-down perspective. This has to be solved by the students themselves. That's critical. And so educating them and encouraging them to be responsive and responsible is our number one priority.
Some campuses have gone so far as to have, you know, step by step, okay, we can go beyond this step, now we can go beyond this step, we can go beyond this step in intimate situations. Is Mizzou going to go that route?
We are very concerned about what yes and no means, like many campuses are. I believe we have, again, a lot of training in place right now. We've mandated every student who entered this campus this year as a freshman go through a training program. They won't be able to get their registration completed till it's done. And that's a big step for us, never done before. So now we have everyone exposed to the same criteria, the same discussions about what their responsibilities are and what the processes are that are available to them to report and also to be able to achieve counseling, support, other kinds of things they may need if they have any issues of this type occurring to them personally.
I guess it's too early for you to see any results of these programs, but what do you sense?
Well, I'll say this, and I'll say it very, very cautiously, and not in a way that I hope is mistaken. We actually have more reports today than we had before. That's not so much a reflection of more activity than before. It's the fact we have a better way for people to know they can report these events and they'll be handled well. We have a better way to handle them in terms of privacy, in terms of support structures than ever before. That's something that's encouraged people to do the right thing, which is to say, this was not a right thing that happened to me, and to come forward and make that statement in the right way to the right people and have it handled. That was not always the way things were before.
I see that hard liquor is going to be barred in fraternity houses on campus. I assume that is a goal to try to prevent some sort of sexual misconduct as well?
Well, I'll just give you my data points. If you look at the last few years of sexual assault cases that have come into student conduct, almost all have involved alcohol abuse by both parties, both the victim and the perpetrator. So you draw your own conclusions from that. I mean, it is what it is. That's what you see. Alcohol plays a role. And underage drinking is especially a problem at any college campus. Mizzou is not free from that. We worked hard to not only teach people about the results of alcohol abuse, we also worked very hard to make sure we have the right people in place. As you may know, Missouri several years ago, through a budget reduction process, eliminated the plainclothes people who used to come into bars and check to make sure that IDs were inspected, things like that. Well, that sort of meant there was nobody looking over anybody's shoulder. So if money's good, and the fact I can get an ID from a website for $20 and a picture, no big deal. So that is part of the equation. So just to give you an example, we encourage Columbia PD to be more visible in the bars downtown in Columbia in terms of checking. We also have hired three new officers on bicycles who actually patrol the streets between the campus and those bars to really be sure people are safe. If you see someone who's obviously inebriated, you don't want them falling into the street in front of a car. You help them get home. We aren't there to punish people. We're there to educate them about the risks they're putting in place by doing this kind of behavior. And that's gotten some traction, I believe. This part we see here that you mentioned is about the Greek leadership itself. This is not a mandate from me, although I certainly encourage it, but to remove the hard liquor, especially things like vodka, which can be consumed in very large quantities without even knowing it, that has been a big deal. And I think the IFC, the Infrared Council, has looked at this very carefully, and they made the decision to come forward and to tell the houses no more hard liquor in the houses. Beer and wine can be appropriately handled in those accredited houses, but not liquor. And that, to me, is a big step forward, driven by the students themselves, not by me.
Let's talk about a couple of other issues that have been in the news recently. Discuss the situation involving graduate students and health insurance.
Okay. We learned back earlier this year, as of July 1, the Internal Revenue Service promulgated a new regulation, which was derived from the Affordable Care Act, which basically said that you can't subsidize employee plans. Employees are supposed to go into other plans. And that was interpreted to include graduate students who at the University of Missouri are not regarded as employees. Our rules and regulations don't label them as employees. They specifically single them out as being not employees, university. But the IRS views them as employees. And so this is where it came from. We and many others began working on this back in the July timeframe. And ultimately, some decided that we had to comply without any other alternative being presented. So that was made known to the students on August the 14th, which happened to be the day before the August 15th expiration of last year's insurance and the beginning of the next year's insurance. Normally, the university paid the entire premium for all the graduate students who were employed by the university as teaching assistants at that time in the year. And they were told on the 14th it wouldn't happen. After a lot of discussion and concerns about that, I made a decision with support from our system the following week to temporarily stop that from happening, to restore the payment of their insurance premium by the university, and to put in place a group led by one of our deans who's a health policy expert and containing a number of students and a faculty member to really explore how we can best deal with this issue. We just needed time to try to solve a problem in the short period of time we had with no student involvement we felt was inappropriate.
The students threatened to walk out. They threatened a strike. Did that affect your decision?
That was not the reason that I went forward and tried to stop this from happening. It was really a matter of doing the right thing. Again, there was no student involvement in the decision-making process. That was a mistake. I apologize for it. I'm sorry it happened. It shouldn't have happened that way. But that's what did happen. And I felt there's risk involved here in doing this because of the potential for us to be cited to be in violation of this regulatory decision. But I felt we owed it to our students to give them a chance to really be part of the process of finding a permanent solution.
Did you really just find out about all the ferment around it on social media?
I did. I was unaware the announcement went out at noon on Friday the 14th until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon when I got out of a meeting and began to look at my Twitter account and saw how much was going on there. That was my first awareness of it.
Is that unusual that you wouldn't know about that in advance?
I was surprised, sir. I was not happy.
Access, affordability, and equality. Talk about how those three things relate as far as your campus goes and how you're trying to make sure that the balance stays the way it's supposed to be.
Well, certainly. I just realize this, that the University of Missouri system has four campuses, one right here where I am today, UMSL. We have one in Kansas City. We have the historic campus in Columbia. We have a campus also at Rolla. Those four campuses are part of a system, and they're all different. None of us are exactly the same, which is fine. And so students in Missouri and elsewhere have a choice. They have a choice of which campus they go to. They may also choose to go outside the system to one of the other four-year schools here in Missouri or elsewhere in the country. That happens each and every day as people make their decisions about their future place for higher education. Access to me is a very important thing. Access has more than one dimension, though. Part of access is simply financial. Can you afford to go to school? Part of access is also intellectual. Do you have the right preparation to be successful? One of the worst things we can do is admit a student who can't make it. And that's a loss for us and a loss for them, too. So we want to be sure students who come to Mizzou are able to complete their studies there, to retain them. I was very proud, for example, this fall that we saw our retention rate from the freshman to sophomore year increasing by a whole percentage point, which is really, that's a big change really year to year. So we had this year 87.1% of our freshmen from last year came back as sophomores. That's a new record for us, for example, and it puts us among the very best in the state, Truman State being probably at our level or maybe a little better even. So that to us is a very important milestone, which says that the academic access is working well for us. We're doing the right thing regarding admitting students and also giving them the right support structures to be successful, especially in their freshman year when they're just learning the ropes. The other part of it, of course, you said financial. That's already really part of access in my mind. Access means that I can afford to come to school and stay in school. If you ask a student why they don't come back in their second year, the first answer I get will be financial. It costs more than I thought it would, and I wasn't prepared for that. My parents were prepared for that. The number two reason is academic. They didn't do well in their first year. Number three reason is a variety of things like family issues and such that happens to anybody. That's a pretty small number. So you see right away that retention is tied really to money, and it's tied also to my academic success, which I've already talked to. So access to me is really the key. I don't have a triad exactly in my mind. I look at the fact that we have the situation where we want to be sure that students can, in fact, come to Mizzou or any school of their choice and be successful there and be able to afford to go there.
When it comes to affordability, though, the state portion of the support for higher education hasn't exactly been robust lately, and that puts more of a onus on the student. Is that a threat to quality?
I think it's a threat to students. This is not Missouri by itself. Every single state has gone through the same process over the last several years. We've seen nationwide a reduction of the per-student support given to universities by states over time. I don't think that will change. I don't believe we're going to see a turn-up of that overnight, if ever. So I believe we have to understand the new reality is that higher education affordability is going to be tied to other things. The state support is vital to us. It helps us keep the cost under control, but it's not going to be the salvation of the future for our universities. Tuition increases have been used by all of us to make up that gap. That has limits too, doesn't it? I've already talked about access. You don't want to price yourself to a point where only wealthy people can afford to come to your school. So what happens? The third piece of this really has been, at least for the last few decades for us, philanthropy. The private schools like WashU have done that for a long time. Privates have come to that conclusion early in their lives. They have to support themselves by going out and getting donors to provide funding. Publics, because they had great state support for a long time, didn't worry about that a whole lot. Now they do. And so where I've been the last decade, my time is spent many weeks, more than half of it, spent on fundraising. That's what we do. So that's part of it. At Mizzou, we think we have a fourth possibility. We have an extraordinarily creative faculty and student population. And we believe that the ideas they come up with, the discoveries they make, oftentimes can have potential in terms of commercial success. So our goal is to be able to support entrepreneurial activities on the part of our faculty and students that allow us to have the ability to draw money from that over time as well. Mizzou right now does very well in licensing much of its technology discoveries, but that's not the better way to do it, in my opinion. We see today the better way to do it is going to be to form joint adventures with outside interests. So if we have a student-faculty group who's made a discovery, let's tie them and the university together with a private organization with capital to establish a new company. Equity belongs to the investor, to the university, to the students and the faculty. And if that company becomes successful, is sold or goes public, your transaction can be in the tens of millions of dollars or more. We have a few examples of that in Mizzou. We want many more. And we think that added to philanthropy will be the best way for us to deal with the future.
How many students do you have on campus from the St. Louis area, and how do you market your campus to them since there's a University of Missouri campus here as well?
Currently, we have about 6,500 St. Louis area students at Mizzou. We have in the city and its surroundings around 55,000 alums. That gives you a sense of the base here, which is sizable. Then if you look at how we recruit, we have a fairly big visibility here because of a couple of things. Again, lots of alums. So many of our applicants are sons and daughters, grandchildren, nephews, nieces of our alums. And so they know about Mizzou very well. They've been taken to Mizzou before. They've come for games, things like that. We reach out specifically here in the city to certain groups. We want to attract groups to Missouri who have great capabilities, so we do reach out here very specifically to high-achieving students who are very competitively sought after by others as well, both inside Missouri and especially outside Missouri. We have a presence here in terms of recruiting that visits high schools. We visit with counselors. We do all the usual things in terms of college fairs, things like that at high schools around the area. But I would say our biggest is simply a sense this is the flagship university of the state of Missouri. My mom and dad went there. I want to go there. My grandparents went there. I want to go there. I have children coming to the campus now who are seventh generation Mizzou grads. Think about that. Their parents, grandparents, and so on back for seven generations have been students. So we have that kind of reach here in St. Louis. But we also target populations here of those who are underserved right now. We specifically want to attract them to Mizzou, and we work hard at that by having physical people on the ground here.
And it doesn't hurt to have big-name basketball, big-name football, does it?
If you want to see some exciting things, the SEC provides it, sir. So we do have an attraction that way, too. The sports focus that Mizzou has had for a long time through the Big 8, now the Big 12 after that, now the SEC, has been attractive for many. People want to be on a campus which has all the pieces. I think UMSL is a fine school. It has a lot of good attributes to it, a lot of good programs, but it's a larger commuter campus. We're residential. And so between the housing on campus, the nearby housing for students around the campus there, people can walk to class. They can walk around. They don't have to drive necessarily. That's helpful. They see a college campus which is beautiful. Not always so. I think Barbara Ewing, when she was the chancellor, is the one that really can be thanked for making the campus look really great. So we see every day people coming to the campus and saying, wow, this place is really nice. And they feel the welcome. If you walk around the campus there looking like you're a stranger, somebody's going to stop and say, can I help you? Not just tell you, but take you where you want to go. That's nice, too. We have organized tours on campus every day. We've got almost 50 young people who are sophomores and juniors. They are tour guides, and they have one common thing. They are passionate about the University of Missouri. That's very important as well. So we house on campus about 7,000 of our students. Most of those are freshmen. It's well known in the literature that freshmen do better academically if they're on campus their first year. Doesn't make a whole lot of difference after that. So we really want to house mostly freshmen on campus. We have a few hundred beds, up to 1,000 perhaps for others, but that's a key for us. After that, they'll find their own way. We have thousands, of course, in the Greek houses as well.
And I guess it's nice to be able to know that if you say three letters, you're going to get three letters right back, right?
Yes, sir. Z-O-U.
M-I-Z-Z-O-U. I've heard the crowd respond. And if you're getting into trouble with a speech and everything, all I have to do is stop and say those things, and you're right automatically right back on track.
Where I used to be, I would use the word howdy. I go into a room now, say M-I-Z, and your attention is now focused very much.
Mizzou Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton speaking with St. Louis Public Radio's Dale Singer. Now that the Ferguson Commission has made its many recommendations, the question becomes, where do we go from here? We'll tackle that question next Monday evening at a town hall meeting at Wellspring Church in downtown Ferguson. You are invited to be a part of the audience. Doors open at 6:15, and the conversation begins at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the status of the radioactive waste and underground fire at the landfill at Bridgeton, and then we'll take a look at the veto session in the Missouri legislature that began at noon today. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.